The following presentation was recorded at the 1999 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Do you impart to your students what privileged characters they are? You live in America, go to nice schools. Have you ever thought about the way we live and what we eat supersedes the plot 18:8 Pastor Beavis 8? We live better than the kings of the past. You know what I mean? No question about it. We have better food, better homes than the kings of the past. What do you think that God intended for us to do with that? Now, here's where I get into trouble, because I'm going to give you a little clue as to how my mind works. And you tell me if I'm wrong. You probably won't, but if you would. Did God intend for us to spend that on mosquitoes? Or what? Have you ever thought that if Jesus would walk into your congregation or your school, or if he was standing here right now, what would he say? Have you ever clue? Or is it full mystery to us? What do you think, Andy?
I think we can know.
And that's not a bad thing at all to contemplate. And it's possible that he would tell you one thing and he might say something to you. Would he tell everybody? He talked to you personally. Would he tell everybody the same thing? Or would it be private? Would he tell everybody the same thing? I'm not talking wrong about it. Have you ever thought if a person wants to know the Lord and follow Jesus, on how little evidence he will do that? If he doesn't want to, on how great a evidence he will reject it? One time in Matthew 11, I believe it is, Jesus said, "I came to you eating and drinking," and he said, "I was a wine bibber." John the Baptist came neither eating nor drinking. He said he had a devil. And I thought about that recently when one of the most influential ministers in our area, it was said of him, everything he does is for show. Do you think that when Jesus was here and he taught, that people could have said, everything he does is for show? When they come to him, for instance, and this is the thing that you need to realize with reading the children, the more senses you can bring to bear on any subject, the greater is going to be the comprehension and the retention. So Jesus didn't say, he didn't say, "Show me a quarter and what's on it." No, he didn't say, "What's on a quarter?" He said, "Show me one." So they all looked at him, and what's he going to say about that? He said, "Whose head is that on?" So he didn't have to. But he brought an object. So you're all looking at this quarter that focuses your attention. So Jesus used these tricks. What do you want to call them? And I thought about that recently, and we're going to get to this, what I said we're going to get to. If you look at Job 38, we had a speech class last year, and I told the students that as a final, at the end of the year, I wanted them to pick a reading, and I wanted them to read it to the whole high school. So here's my hair, Melinda. Okay. Privilege seat. It's a $10 seat. I want you to read it to the whole high school. I don't care if it's a poem, if it's a letter your mother wrote you, a Bible, whatever you want to read. And one of the girls picked this 38th chapter of Job. And one of the benefits of having a student read to students is they will listen more to a student than they will a teacher at times, maybe not always. But they're fascinated by listening to a student. Well, I'm not standing in front of this thing, am I?
Sorry. They're fascinated to see a fellow student. And so this girl picked this 38th chapter of Job. I have no idea what brought this to her mind. You say, well, Job, that would be kind of boring. But she read this thing, and she read it. Then the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind and said, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? And periodically she would look at the students and say, have you done that? Gird up thy loins like a man. For I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if thou hast understanding, where were you? And she went through that whole thing, and the students were spellbound. Really. I mean, she made the 38th chapter of Job come alive. And you can apply it to yourself. You have all those answers? I mean, God asked Job all these things. And it brought to mind, you could almost open the Bible at random and you could make it interesting. There is a message there. There is always more to see and hear than what's seen and heard. Have you ever heard that? There's always more to see and hear than what is seen and heard. And that was true of Jesus' teachings. And for instance, this chart on the wall, and I didn't know that Brenda was going to put that up, but it says over here, eternity future. And it says over there, eternity past. Could anybody tell me what's in between? Does eternity stop for time? It's true. Time is in between. But also, what's in between? Janice. Yeah, right. Eternity present. We're in eternity. In fact, if you have Jesus' life, and I didn't think about it when I put the scripture up here. Ye have, this is life eternal, is present tense. If you have Jesus' life, if you know Jesus Christ, you have life eternal. You have eternal life now. It's not some carrot in the future. Time doesn't stop for eternity. And so you might ask, is this wall chart literature? Now, I didn't yesterday, and we're always reluctant to do this, and then I get reminded. It's interesting maybe to know just about a little bit about who's speaking to you, and so is a very, very brief brief. I do teach school, high school. I think Melvin told you I've done that for 20 years. I am temporarily the principal of the school where I teach, which has 130 students enrolled for this month starts. I don't really want to be a principal. And this is the second year of the school where I'm teaching, and I told the board that I would do it temporarily for 2 years to get started because I like to teach. I would rather deal with teenagers than I would parents. I find there, this is a little bit crude to say this, but I'll say it this way. I find their hypocrisy less masked and easier to puncture. Does that make sense? Barbara and I have 4 children, and I don't know, 15, 16 grandchildren, including 1.98 great-grandchildren. My granddaughter is overdue. I am a minister in a congregation where I worship. And I've lived all my life in California. In fact, I live not too far from where my father was born. Now, I say that because the first time I was ever in the East, about 11 years ago or whenever it was, when we came to Faith Builders, we would meet people in Lancaster, and they were sure that if people like me was in California, we must have just moved there. Because people's view, uneducated view of California, is either San Francisco or Hollywood. Well, there's a lot of space in between, right, Melinda? So in a way, I am a Westerner, and that can say volumes, but we won't go into that. Melinda's great, great grandmother, I think, or something, and my great grandfather came to California in about the turn of the century. That's close enough. So that's basically who I am. There's a man in our area. He's a Dutchman. There's a lot of Dutchmen in our area. I'll tell you about two of them. One of them lives just down the road from me, John Hedega. And he is a Christian man. He's traveled all over the world. And people ask him what church he goes to. And he says, "There's more than one." He doesn't belong to, quote, any church. So he belongs to the church. There's another Dutchman in our area who is a Gideon. And about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, the Gideons had a meeting in Los Angeles, which is 320 miles south of us. Now, I'm telling you partly to reinforce a story that I'm going to read, and partly to ask you the question, when you say all written material is literature, some people think that's too broad. Other people think it isn't broad enough, because is storytelling literature? And so I'm going to tell you this story. As far as I know, it's not written down. Gideon Mann in Los Angeles for a meeting. After the meeting one night, it was late at night, they went into this restaurant. These Gideon men sat in a booth, and in the booth next to them was an older man and his wife. And somehow they struck up a conversation. I don't know the details of this. And in the conversation, this man in the booth got to telling them how in World War II he was a bomber pilot. And they were shot down over Holland and crashed. And of the eight crewmen, I believe two of them were killed. And a little eight-year-old Dutch boy rescued the other six of them, got them to the underground before the Nazis got them, and they all got back to England. And the man said, "And I gave that little Dutch boy my pistol." This Dutchman from our area said, "That was me. I still have the pistol." And there would have been a time when I had a little hard time believing some of those stories. But I've grown up since then, and I find them very easy to believe. I want to read you one of those. Has anybody ever read "It Happened on the Brooklyn Subway"? Read it out of this book? Huh? Is in a magazine. And there are a lot of stories like this. And I really, in a way, wish somebody else would read this, because I always have a hard time not crying when I read it. There are two different explanations of what happened as the result of a subway ride taken by a Hungarian-born Marcel Sternberger on the afternoon of January 10th, 1948. And I like to read this to the high school, and at the end he brings this up again and asks them what they think the explanation is for what happened. And you'll get a lot of interesting conversation. Some people will say that Sternberger's sudden impulse to visit a sick friend in Brooklyn and the bright world of dramatic events that followed was part of a string of lucky coincidences. Others will see the guiding hand of divine providence in everything that happened that day. But whatever the explanation, here's what happened. Sternberger, a New York portrait photographer living in a Long Island suburb, has followed for years an unchanging routine of going from his home to his office on Fifth Avenue. A methodical man of nearly 50 with bushy white hair, guileless brown eyes, and bouncing enthusiasm of a dancer of his native Hungary, Sternberger always takes the 909 Long Island Railroad train to Woodside, at which station he catches a subway train to the city. On the morning of January 10th, he boarded the 909 as usual. En route, he suddenly decided to visit Laszlo Viktor, a Hungarian friend who lived in Brooklyn and who was ill. "I don't know why I decided to go to see him that morning," Sternberger told me some weeks afterwards. "I could have done it after office hours, but I kept thinking that he could stand a little cheering up." Accordingly, at Ozone Park, Sternberger changed to the subway for Brooklyn, went to his friend's house, and stayed until mid-afternoon. He then boarded a Manhattan-bound subway for his office. "The car was crowded," Sternberger told me, "and there seemed to be no chance of a seat. But just as I entered, a man sitting by the door suddenly jumped up to leave, and I slipped into his empty space." I've been living in New York long enough not to be in the habit of starting conversations with strangers. But being a photographer, I have the peculiar habit of analyzing people's faces. And I was struck by the features of the passenger on my left. He was probably in his late 30s, and his eyes seemed to have a hurt expression in them. He was reading a Hungarian language newspaper, and something prompted me to turn to him and say in Hungarian, "I hope you don't mind if I glance at your paper." The man seemed surprised to be addressed in his native language, but he answered politely, "You may read it now. I'll have time later on." During the half-hour ride to town, we had quite a conversation. He said his name was Paskin. A law student, when the war started, he had been put into a labor battalion and sent to the Ukraine. Later, he was captured by the Russians and put to work burying the German dead. After the war, he had covered hundreds of miles on foot until he reached his home in Debrecen, a large city in eastern Hungary. I myself know Debrecen quite well, and we talked about it for a while. Then he told me the rest of his story. When he went to the apartment, once occupied by his father, mother, brothers, and sisters, he found strangers living there. Then he went upstairs to the apartment he and his wife had once had. It also was occupied by strangers. None of them ever heard of his family. As he was leaving, full of sadness, a boy ran after him, calling, "Paskin! Baksi! Paskin Baksi!" That means Uncle Paskin. The child was the son of some old neighbors of his. He went to the boy's home and talked to his parents. "Your whole family is dead," they told him. "The Nazis took them and your wife to Auschwitz." Auschwitz was one of the worst concentration camps. Paskin thought of the Nazi gas chambers and gave up all hope. A few days later, too heartsick to remain longer in Hungary, which to him was a funeral land, he set out again on foot, stealing across border after border until he reached Paris. He had managed to emigrate to the United States in October 1947, just 3 months before I met him. All the time he had been talking, I kept thinking that somehow his story seemed familiar. Suddenly I knew why. A young woman whom I had met recently at the home of friends had also been from Debrecen. She had been sent to Auschwitz. From there she had been transferred to work in a German munitions factory. Her relatives had been killed in the gas chambers. Later, she was liberated by the Americans and was brought here in the first boatload of displaced persons in 1946. Her story had moved me so much that I had written down her address and phone number, intending to invite her to meet my family and thus help relieve the terrible emptiness in her present life. It seemed impossible that there could be any connection between these two people, but when I reached my station, I stayed on the train and asked in what I hoped was a casual voice, "Is your first name Bella?" If I could stop here, that reminds me, I was going to college and a professor told us a story a World War II story. Right after the war, there were a lot of veterans going to college, and he said the first day of class in this engineering hydrology class, right in the front row, these two men come and sit down side by side. And the one looked at the other one, and he thought he looked like a boy that he went to first grade with. And so after class, but all he couldn't remember his name, all he could remember is that he had a pet chicken named Henrietta. And so after class, he turned to this man and he said, "Did you used to have a pet chicken named Henrietta?" And it was the same man. They'd gone through, ever since first grade, gone through whatever they'd gone through, and they ended up sitting down side by side in this class. "Is your name Bella?" He turned pale. "Yes," he answered. "How'd you know?" Now, if you read this to students, depending on the level, I mean, you can ask them, "Well, what's going to happen?" And usually they've got it figured out. And if they're used to you asking that kind of questions, then they're going to follow the story because they know at some point in time you're going to ask them, "What do you think is going to happen?" Or whatever. You can ask all kinds of questions. It keeps them listening. I fumbled anxiously in my address book. "Was your wife's name Maria?" He looked as if he was about to faint. "Yes, yes," he said. I said, "Let's get off the train." I took him by the arm at the next station and led him to a phone booth. He stood there like a man in a trance while I searched for the number in my address book. It seemed hours before I had the woman called Myra Paskin on the other end. Later, I learned her room was alongside the telephone, but she was in the habit of never answering it because she had so few friends and the calls were always for someone else. This time, however, there was no one else at home, and after letting it ring for a while, she answered it. When I heard her voice at last, I told her who I was and asked her to describe her husband. She seemed surprised at the question, but gave me a description. Then I asked her where she had lived in Debrecen, and she told me the address. Asking her to hold the wire, I turned to Paskin and said, "Did you and your wife live on such and such a street?" "Yes," Bella exclaimed. He was white as a sheet and trembling. "Try to be calm," I urged him. "Something miraculous is about to happen. Here, take this telephone and talk to your wife." He nodded his head in mute bewilderment, his eyes bright with tears. He took the receiver, listened a moment to his wife's voice, then suddenly cried, "This is Bella, this is Bella," and he began to mumble hysterically. Seeing that the poor fellow was so excited he couldn't talk, I took the receiver from his shaking hand. I began talking to Maria, who also sounded hysterical. "Stay where you are," I told her. "I'm sending your husband to you. He'll be there in a minute." Bella was crying like a baby and saying over and over again, "It's my wife, it's my wife." At first I thought I'd better accompany Paskin lest the man should faint from excitement, but decided that this was a moment in which no stranger should intrude. Putting Paskin into a taxicab, I directed the driver to take him to Maria's address, paid the fare, and said goodbye. Bella Paskin's reunion with his wife was a moment so poignant, so electric, with suddenly released emotion that afterwards neither he nor Maria could recall anything about it. I remember only that when I left the telephone, I walked to the mirror like in a dream to see myself if my hair had turned gray, she said later. The next thing I know, a taxi stops in front of the house, and it's my husband who comes toward me. Details I cannot remember. Only this I know, that I was happy for the first time in many years. Even now, it's difficult to believe that it happened. We have both suffered so much. I have almost lost the capability to be not afraid. Each time my husband goes from the house, I say to myself, will anything happen to him? Her husband is confident that no overwhelming misfortune will ever befall them. Providence has brought us together, he says simply. It's meant to be. Skeptical persons would no doubt attribute the event of that memorable afternoon to mere chance. But was it chance that made Steinberger suddenly decide to visit his sick friend and hence take a subway line that he had never been on before? Was it chance that caused the man sitting by the door of the car to rush out just as Sternberger came in? Was it chance that caused Bella Paskin to be sitting beside Sternberger reading a Hungarian newspaper? Was it chance, or did God ride the Brooklyn subway? Now, you can look at stories like that
And you could ask, what is the point of that story? Well, there would be a lot of points in that story. But children, at whatever age, need to learn that God actively works in the lives of men. That would certainly be one lesson you would get out of that, wouldn't it? Now, if they are brought to the knowledge that God works in the lives of men, what does that do for them? Anybody? Huh? Well, yeah, if he works in the lives of men, they're people. So the most powerful, subtle message of that is God's going to work in your life. And they need to believe that. Now, I hope no one will get upset with me if I ask you, and I could pick on somebody and say, did you look up what the word taciturn means? Did anybody do that? You already knew it. Okay? You see, that kind of thing, I like to do that with students. I didn't tell you to look it up, did I? But I didn't tell you what it meant. And your students will learn that when you do that, you mean for them to look it up. And so if one student looked it up, you can give them a privilege. Now, the next time you do that, they may all look it up because they all want the privilege, and then you don't give any privilege. And so you get into this game, guessing game with them. But what have you done in doing that? Well, you've got their attention, for one thing, and that's a good thing to have. But you've also got them interested in words. So just think about that. Don't always tell them what a word means. In fact, I seldom do. They are famous for coming up. I mean, how many of you that have taught, they come up to me all the time and say, what does this word mean? And I say, well, I know what it means, but I also know where you can learn what it means. And they need to learn to use a dictionary. And that seems to be a real difficult thing to do. Now, I didn't really do one more thing. We're just going to do a couple house cleaning things here. On the last days of this, I didn't say anything about it. You know, session 4 and session 5, I don't have a lot there. But I think hope some of this is going to roll into that. And I would hope that even today, some of you will have a critique of a book. Obviously, we haven't developed the criteria, but you could still do it. And I mentioned that yesterday, and I'd appreciate it if some of you would do that. So just because there isn't a lot under session 4 and 5, I consider it may be a couple of the most valuable sessions. A little bit more about my background. My father and mother were both poets. My father went through the sixth grade, and when I think about, and this is something you can bring up with your student, what's the definition of an educated person? You ever think about that? We talk about somebody, and you hear that phrase, somebody is educated. What does that mean? And when I think of that, I think of the man that we hired one time. He had a degree in mathematics from a local college. And when I worked for the city of Modesto as an engineer, we hired him. He had a hard time getting a job, and it was kind of in a time when jobs were hard to get. And we hired him to work on the survey crew, and he was worthless. It's the only person that anybody had ever heard of that went to work for the city of Modesto that got fired. And it took us 2 years to fire him because of civil service. You had to get all, took 2 years, And the survey chief told me, he said, he is worthless. We would rather go out on the job without him than with him. So he had a degree in mathematics. Was he educated? Peter Hoover never finished high school. He has a GED. Now, I don't know how many languages he knows. Somebody said he knows 3, and somebody said he knows 7, and it doesn't make any difference. Is he an educated man? I know a black man in Oakland. I've met him and talked to him, who speaks 27 languages. I would trade everything I know if I could speak three. And so when I think about that, I think of my father. He sort of finished sixth grade. But he could write poetry, he could quote poetry, and so could my mother. And part of that, and so you, and here it goes into background and tradition, which was kind of the thing of the colloquy. And so I learned to love that from my father. Where did he learn it? Well, if you can picture he was born in 1903, so if you can picture 1910, 1920, 25, do you know what young folks in our area did on Sundays and when they got together for young folks gatherings in that era? They wrote and recited poetry and stories from memory. That's what they did for entertainment. Now, and again, here's where I get into trouble. What do we do for entertainment? Now, you could say boring, right? Boring. Is that boring? They enjoyed it. Have we lost something with all our technology? I think so. You say, well, there's no use decrying that. Here we are. And so you can't jump back 70 years. Does that mean we can't do better than we do? What do you boys think? It's interesting to me that if you bring up that subject, then you get labeled, as I do, as being anti-sports. Isn't that amazing? And nobody loves to play softball and volleyball any better than I do. But I vigorously object to it controlling our lives.
So my best memory of being here at Gatefield is when the youth store at St. Andy's House came to me. We all took children's books along and we just read children's stories.
Thank you. We took the high school this year to Death Valley on a 3-day trip, rented a big bus, and the two nights that we stayed, that brings us to mind what she said. The two nights we stayed in motels. We had, there was 41 of us, I think. There was three or four adults, and the rest of them were students. We stayed in motels, and both nights we got together in one room. You can picture one motel room, 41 people, sitting all over the floor, beds, furniture, everything, and had devotions and talk, and we sang, and the second night, I put students in charge of it. I wasn't in charge of it. I told them to do whatever you want. And the second night, the one that was in charge had everybody talk. And afterwards, when they did a critique of the year, the end of the school year, they did a critique. I just wanted them to write down what was important to them that happened during the year. I was amazed. Guess what most of them said? Those two nights in the motel room. No TV, no whatever. Just getting together, talking, singing, reading the Bible. That kind of told me something. The spirit isn't all dead, is it? Still alive. So I have a cartoon here. What happened to it? That I was going to ask you about. I wanted to put it on the overhead, but I couldn't find the proper thing to copy it on the overhead. It's this Blondie cartoon. And in the first setting, Dagwood, that's it. Blondie and Dagwood are sitting, and his boss and his wife are sitting. And Blondie says, "What's the secret of your successful marriage?" And the rich woman says, "We never had a quarrel that we weren't able to resolve with love, patience, and understanding." And then the man speaks up and says, large chunks of jewelry also. And she says, well, yeah, that too. That's writing. Is there a message to it? Is there a message to it? Is it true? Is the message true? Yeah. Is that literature? I pulled in a parking lot one day, and here's this blonde, totally chick gal gets out of this little red sports car. It had a bumper sticker on it. I hate bumper stickers on my own car, but I love to read them on other people's. The bumper sticker said, I don't know, I don't care, and it doesn't matter. Is that literature? Was there a message in that? The message fit her exactly. There was a message in it. I think that's exactly where she was. She didn't know, she didn't care, and it didn't matter. So is bumper sticker literature? Well, that sounds kind of far out, doesn't it? I mean, there's something about us we kind of want to refuse to, you know, we don't want to. So, whatever. I want to mention, and I forgot to mention this in the beginning, my greatest goal, I sort of alluded to it, my greatest goal, there is a poem, I think it's The House by the Side of the Road, but I'm not sure right now, but it has the phrase in it that though they may forget the singer, they will not forget the song. And my greatest goal, really, then this week, is that you would forget about me, but you would learn something that would, in your heart, you could praise the Lord more than you ever had before, and you could pass that on to your students through literature. In the highest sense, that is my goal. You need to think about the Bible as literature. You can read the Song of Solomon. How many of you have ever read the Song of Solomon? I'll just put it that way. How many of you understood it? So we read it. I brought this up at a Bible study recently, and an older brother said, I asked him, I said, what do you get out of the Song of Solomon? And he said, absolutely nothing. So that takes a little bit of searching. But there is some heavy, heavy, heavy message in the Song of Solomon. And we're not going to go into that. You can read the Bible as literature, and if you read it as good literature, if you read it in the anagnosko sense, there's a heavy, heavy message, I believe, in all of it. Now, one more thing before we get to the primary thing that we're going to do this morning. I really appreciated you filling out those questionnaires and taking that test and your comments at the bottom. And I thought those comments would be very, very scattered, but they weren't. And I think primarily, except in one or two cases, we're going to cover exactly what you mentioned that you wanted to learn. And if we don't do that by the last day, you tell me. There was one comment, and it doesn't matter who made it, that I do want to talk about. We are primarily, in our setting here, talking about motivating the teachable to appreciate good literature. And we probably will not speak to trying to motivate the unteachable. Not because they don't need to be taught, but that's not what we're doing here, and that is a whole different ballgame. Trying to motivate the teachable as opposed to motivating the unteachable is as much different as pickup sticks is from pro ball. It's a whole different ballgame. And the reason for that is, you see, God's final solution for man. God had tried everything with man. He spoke directly to man in the pre-flood era. How'd that go? Not very good. He tried to speak through one central agent then, let's say in the Abrahamic era, and that didn't go so good. They all ended up down in Egypt slaves, worshiping the Egyptian gods. So then he said, well, I'll write everything down. And how did that go? Didn't work, did it? And that goes back to this subject. If you want to do a study, I've asked many people this. We forget sometimes when we read the New Testament and it refers to the Scripture that it's always referring to the Old Testament. For instance, when Jesus was walking on the Emmaus Way, and it says he started at the beginning and he told them all the Scriptures pertaining to himself, we tend in our mind to think about New Testament Scriptures, but he was talking about Old Testament. Did you ever wonder what all those were? Wouldn't that be an interesting list to have? How were they supposed to learn about Jesus Christ out of the Old Testament? I think it had been difficult. But it shows that a person that had their faith right, that was disposed to believe in God, believed on very little evidence. In fact, Melvin brought up the Syrophoenician woman. How did she have such a faith in God that Jesus Christ himself could insult her and she kept right on coming? I mean, we don't even want our brother to insult us or we're liable to quit going to church. But she, and I think that Jesus did that. He knew what was in her heart. He knew she could take. He did that as a testimony to those around him. Here's a Syrophoenician woman, barely knows anything about me, but she knows that I have something she needs and she's going to get it. And if you want to know God, if you really want to know God, you can get it. Go for it. Your brother doing whatever, is that going to stop you from it? And too many times we let the people around us distract us from our goal of knowing God. Isn't that true? True of me. I mean, how many of you would say, not me? And so God's solution, and I just wanted to bring this up, I want to say this about it. God's solution, his final solution, nothing worked. And there is a heavy message in this for us with the unteachable. For several years, every Tuesday night, I went to juvenile hall, local juvenile hall, and talked to boys and girls. And we've gone to other prisons, as I'm sure some of you have. No big deal in one way. But I love to ask the guards, the people that you see there, and I say, how's this system working? I mean, here we are spending millions of dollars on this system. How's it work? I've never had one of them but what said, it's not working. And too many times as Christian people, we try to use that same kind of thing, the same methods, in other words, exterior control on a behavior in order to correct the situation. Now, I'm talking about teens and beyond. That exterior control is biblical, if you read Galatians, in controlling younger children. And so what was God's final solution? And once we realize what God's final solution was, that's the final solution that we use on people too, children. And God's final solution was his love through Jesus Christ. And I would submit to you, and this may sound simplistic, you may say, won't work. But my experience has been that it will work. The only solution for handling a teen and beyond that is trapped in the habits of sin is they must be shown God's redeeming love by you. And I think about the boy. It was the end of the year. He was a freshman, ending his freshman year. And he'd been a problem. This was the first school I taught in. I was very concerned about him, and his parents were very concerned about him. I still remember we walked outside the classroom like the last day of school. I put my arm around him and said, I'll call him Paul. I said, Paul, I just want you to know that I do love you. And he jerked away and pushed me away. And I told his parents about that. Now, my first reaction, what do you think my first reaction to that was? Well, one, you're hurt, and one, you think, well, forget you, right? I mean, that's just a natural reaction. I got to thinking about that, and you know what? Hey, I don't know what happened. Don't know what happened, except this. He came back that next fall a totally different boy. And his parents asked me, said, what happened to him? And I told him what happened, and that was it. One of the most dramatic turnarounds I've ever seen. And we've been great friends ever since. So we do make a difference in the children's lives. And one way that we can make a difference is through what we read to them. In fact, if the phrase known and read of all men, in a way, our lives are literature. Have you ever thought about that? Is that too far out? Do you ever think? Your life is a story. Your life is literature. And so then the question comes up, is it good or bad? It may be the most powerful literature that the child will ever see is your life. Now, before I forget, when we come back in, we're going to take a break right around 10 o'clock. We need to sing a song. So will somebody volunteer to start us with a song when we come back in? Anybody? You will? Thank you. Now, what we want to do, you need to read that. I'll probably erase it before the day's out. What we want to do is this thing, and I don't know whether you do this or not, and you don't need to. I'm not saying that it's a necessary ingredient, but children like it. It breaks up the day. Some people call it jigsawing. Some people call it whatever you want. Cooperative learning. It's a tool of cooperative learning. I don't know if that means anything to you or not. But if you do it with your children at school, it needs to be very structured, and it needs to be done. So when you say get into your groups, they know exactly what to do. Now, what's the danger of picking, let's say, four students here in your classroom and saying you're a group, and you give them an assignment to do, and you're all going to get the same assignment, and you four here, you're a group, and you give them assignment to do whatever. What's the danger of that? What's going to happen? Speak to me.
One person does the work and you sit there and watch them.
Thank you. Isn't that right? One, maybe two, is going to do the whole thing. There's going to be one or two of them. Don't even pay any attention. They're going to be thinking about supper that night or whatever. So what do you do with that? What's the point in having a group and one of them doing it all? So what do you do with it? Anybody? Well, the thing you do with it is if there's a group, and you can change this every month, every quarter, do whatever you want, but you say, you make as many of these as you want, you're going to be the secretary. Or this group decides you're going to write it down. So now she's involved, whether she wants to be or not. Right? You're going to be the person that oversees this whole thing and make sure everybody's involved. And so if nobody's saying anything, you're going to ask her what she thinks about this, and then you're going to tell her that's good, you write it down. You're going to kind of be that. You're going to be a person that if I walk up to this group and say, how are you getting along? Then you're going to tell me. So I know when I walk up to this group, I'm going to go, you. I know that she's going to tell me what's going on. I said, how are you getting along? We're already about done. And I want you all looking at each other. She's going to tell me. She knows that's her job. So now she has to pay attention to what she's writing down, what everybody's saying. So you got her involved. As a fourth one, you can just have them as an encourager. I want you to listen to everything that's said and maybe make an extension to it. Or maybe you ask another person what. So you get everybody involved. You can make many. Maybe you can have two people write it down if you have five and you need something for somebody to do. Just keep everybody involved. And they know now when you say get into their groups, she knows she's going to write down what happens. She knows that she's going to be the spokesman. And you don't have to go through all that. Right. How many of you ever done that? Well, you don't have to. You can be a very successful teacher. No, you can try it. Do children like that kind of thing? Sure they do. Can learning take place? What's the point of it all? People say, what's the point of it all? Well, the point of it all is this. I don't think I have to tell you that adults have a hard time getting along with adults. And to me, one big thing that happens in all of this is they learn to work as a team and get along. Is that a good thing for us all to learn? In traveling around the country and working with schools, I find one of the greatest problems in schools is teachers getting along. And here we are teaching children and we want them to get along and we don't. Does that make any sense? It don't make any sense to me. And Melinda knows, I think about every time we get together, stop me. I say, we're going to get along as Christian people. If we don't, somebody's going to be missing. It's either going to be me or you, because I'm not sticking around. I don't think God meant for us to work in a situation where we're at odds with the people that we're working with. What does Ephesians say? We ought to be getting together as teachers and encouraging each other. Our Christian life should be a battleground with the devil, right? Or the unsaved. Did God mean for it to be a battleground with the saved? And so children can learn that in group things. It's one real benefit of them having group learning. They need to learn to get along. They need to learn that they have a place to fill and they need to do it. We've heard all our lives that, you know, two minds, three minds, four minds is better than one. So if you're bringing these four children's minds focused on one task, they're probably going to do a better job. We can learn from each other, all kinds of things that they can learn. Now, if we did this, I don't want to string this out too long, and so I've toyed with the idea on how to do this. And it looks to me like the easiest way, and I was going to wait till 10 o'clock, but it'd be best probably, I'm trying to decide whether to take a break before we start this or after. Anybody have a suggestion? Does anybody have a book review they want to do? We can delay this till, good. Come on up. I just hate to get started in all this and not finish it. If anybody else does, let's do some.
This is a devotional book. I'm trying to find the... you might say that what's wrong with the devotional book? I'd like to read one to you. Will the fairy come? Bonnie wiggled and wiggled. She used her tongue to push it too. Finally, her loose tooth came out. Bonnie carefully wrapped up the tooth. She put it on her bed under the pillow. Bonnie hoped the tooth fairy would come that night and leave her some money. Somebody watched all this. The peeker was Bobby. Bobby was Bonnie's little brother. He was 3 years old. Can you guess what Bobby did? First, Bobby tried to wiggle all his teeth. Nothing happened. Then Bobby thought and thought and thought. Bobby went outside. He found a pine cone. He put the pine cone under his pillow. Then Bobby went and told his mother. Mommy, I'm all ready for the pine cone fairy to come tonight. The fairy will find a pine cone under my pillow and leave me some money. Do you think the pine cone fairy visited Bobby? Sometimes we want something very much. First, Bobby wanted to be like his older sister with a loose tooth. Then Bobby wanted to have a visit from a fairy. What is something you wish for? And this is the verse that goes along with this.
How good it is to give thanks to you, O Lord. And then there's a little prayer that goes with it too. I guess what I would say about this book is that there's a lot of good stuff in it. It gets you stimulated to have discussion with a young child. It's for ages 8 and under. But what I have a problem with this piece here is that it doesn't bring out the fact that there is no tooth fairy. It leaves the child with the idea that it's possible that this pine cone fairy won't come, but the tooth fairy isn't mentioned in a negative way at all. And so I would put this in my own library, but I would be careful how I would bring out some of these discussions, and there would probably be some of these devotions that I would skip, or at least revise them.
I read that book to first graders, and she's right. You read that, and it gives you an opportunity to overcome whatever objections you have to the story. And that really opens a great door, right? Have you ever heard Christian people say, I mean, Christmas? There's nothing wrong with a little child telling them about Santa Claus. I mean, he's just a kid. Does that matter? You ever hear that? Then it was pointed out, here's a young man or girl grows up, to whatever extent, starts to doubt God, and then she gets to thinking about Dad. And, well, Dad told me that there was a Santa Claus, and that wasn't true. Maybe there's no Jesus Christ either. Obviously, I can't rely on what Dad said. Then that'd be a good opportunity to bring that up. Tooth fairy. Dangerous business, isn't it? Really? And yet you don't want to be have a McCarthyism complex. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Yeah, or finding fault with everything and, you know, being negative about everything. We have to be careful about that. And yet, we do have to be careful. So there's a lot of good stories in there. And the children like them, and you can hold them up while you read them. And it gives you an opportunity. It's a good book. Anybody else? Yes.
This morning I started reading this Sugar Creek Gang book, and I read the first two pages and I realized that I'd read the whole book. Long before we left Sugar Creek for our winter vacation along the Rio Grande River, I had been sure that when we went fishing down there, we'd catch a fish as big as a boy. I was so sure of it, about it, that I started in telling nearly everybody I met. Why, that great big fish we were going to land might even be as big as little Jim, the smallest member of our gang, or maybe as big around as Poetry, the barrel-shaped member, the most mischievous one of us, who, because he wants to be a detective someday, is always getting us mixed up in some mysterious and exciting adventure. But say, instead of a big fish, we caught something else just as big and had to pounce down upon it and hold on to it for dear life, or it would have gotten away, and also had to keep on holding on, or maybe we'd have gotten our eyes scratched out, or ourselves badly slashed up. Well, I just couldn't have imagined anything so excitingly different happening to a gang of ordinary boys. When I got that far, I realized that that's about the sum of the book. Really no depth. However, I remember being a 10-year-old myself and found Sugar Creek very exciting. And, well, yes, very exciting. It's something that turned me on, and I had to read the whole book through. But it was all done. I hadn't really gotten much. Now, I'd also like to turn back further in the book and read a short section So the whole way through your book, you're looking for that adventure. But they're down there in Texas, and they're on the border between Texas and Mexico. And one night they attend a revival meeting. And I guess the preacher gets up. Oh, there was a boy evangelist there. That's what it was. A boy evangelist, 10, 12 years old, preaching. And then after he was done and sit down, why, this older man gets up and gives the invitation. And a lot of people responded, you know, and I'll just start reading right here. Well, it was really swell, and maybe 20 people were saved that night before the meeting was over. I guess I never saw any prettier sight in my life than all those people in that friendly little canvas-walled room giving their hearts to God. Something inside of me felt like a Sugar Creek song, not the kind people sing in church, but like the friendly, purling noise with Sugar Creek itself makes when the water from the spring tumbles into it. All these happy people with tears in their eyes made me think of that. I felt as good as I do when I see a fiery red cardinal winging across the sunshiny sky from one tree to another. For some reason, it seemed like God, who could make such wonderful things as Sugar Creek and red birds for boys to enjoy, was turning loose a whole flock of cardinals to fly around in people's hearts or something. I shouldn't be too cynical, I guess, but I do know from personal experience that painting the Christian conversion in such a cheap light is you don't want to do that to a child. This is neither true of the Christian experience, nor does it reflect the richness of the Christian's experience. It's a cheap representation of conversion. And I personally think that while a book like this maybe has some value for entertaining a boy's adventure spirit, that the picture of Christianity that it gives is one that will let a child down when he actually gives his heart to the Lord himself, when he comes to that point. And so that's just my commentary.
Thank you. I would say amen to that. Now, what will be interesting is the criteria we develop. What will it say about that book? That's going to be the crux of the matter, right? I mean, it'd be interesting to see. I would say that's a fair evaluation of that book. I've read the whole thing. Anybody else? Then let's take a break until 5 after. I know there wasn't water for a while, and I don't know what all you may have to do. You probably won't understand this, but it's worth it to me to come here to listen to you sing. And if I don't speak loud enough, or this isn't enough, you can hear back there, you ought to speak up. I mean, let me know. Now, we're ready to start this. Does anybody have any questions about it? So what we're going to do, instead of four, you're going to turn around. You four is going to work with those four, so your team of eight. Now, I realize not everybody can be a secretary and not everybody and all that we talked about. But in the interest of not prolonging this thing too long, that's what we're going to do. So what?
Well, you four are going to just turn around. We're going to work with those four. We're going to develop between four and six criteria, guidelines, rules, whatever you want to call them, that if you follow these and you read this book and you say it meets this criteria, it's okay to put it on the library shelf. Any questions about that?
The library committee faces this all the time. So you four are going to turn around. You four.
Yes.
I would say that's true. That's like a library committee would be doing. You're going to pretend you're a library committee. So we're going to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We're going to end up with 8 sets of criteria. And when we do that, then after we do that, then we're going to...
keep going until we have one set.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.